Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Yes, well, it's still really the beginning of the year, I know, and many of you would have made New Year's resolutions. I didn't. I can say hand on heart, pardon the pun, I did not make any New Year's resolutions this year, but lots of people do, and I know a lot of them around diet and exercise and just generally living a more healthy life. That's all good and well. How do you do it? We're going to talk about heart health tonight in particular. What are some of the best tips to prevent heart disease and other heart conditions? And how do you maintain a healthy lifestyle without having to compromise too much? In 2016, 52 Australians died from heart disease every day. And heart disease was responsible for a death every 30 minutes. Getting a heart check from your GP is an easy process, and we'll let you know how you can do that in just a moment. And also, what are the new advances in looking after your heart as well? Joining us tonight, clinical cardiologist and associate professor Raj Puranik from the University of Sydney. Raj, terrific to have you in, and welcome to Nightlife.
Thanks very much, Phil.
Great to have you with us. And also, chief of the New South Wales Heart Foundation, Kerry Doyle. Kerry, good evening to you.
Good evening.
Terrific to have you in as well. How do you get a heart check anyway, Kerry?
So you need to go to your GP, and you need to ask them for a heart health check. We had great success last year, in fact, getting the Commonwealth Government to provide Medicare support for heart health checks. So it's now something that the GPs are becoming much more aware of.
Okay.
And remunerated for as well.
Okay, what is it anyway?
So basically it's having a good conversation with your GP, understanding your family history. Also understanding your lifestyle risk factors. Those will be things like your levels of physical activity, are you overweight, obese, your dietary habits, smoking, things like that. And very importantly, also understanding what your blood pressure is and what your cholesterol levels are. And then assessing some of those other things that are contributors, like your status of towards diabetes or your blood sugars, as most people know them.
What are the most? I mean, are blood pressure and cholesterol levels still the key indicators of a healthy heart or otherwise?
So we talk about absolute risk, and your absolute risk takes into account all of the things that I've just described. It's your family history, it's your lifestyle risk factors, and then it's those two things that you can't know about unless you have your GP check your blood pressure and your cholesterol. So it's the package that gives you your risk of actually developing heart disease or having a heart attack in the next, say, 5 years.
Yeah, family history is a big one, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
We can't do much about it.
You can outrun a lot of things, but you can't often outrun
it.
But you can modify.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that, because that's interesting, because lots of people, knowing their family history, that's right, I've thought, oh, well, I'll exercise more and have a better diet, which has improved their life, no question. But as you say, if you've got a very bad family history, the cards are stacked against you, aren't they?
They are, but this, again, is a critical reason for going to the GP in the first place and having the heart health check, because you can actually find out the status of the cards that you're holding at a particular point in time.
Being overweight also leads to heart problems, doesn't it?
It's one of a series of contributing factors. Obesity is a significant contributing factor, as you, I'm sure, appreciate. You know, the harder your body's got to work to move you around, the more pressure you're putting on your heart. But it is that absolute risk of developing cardiovascular disease that we're really focused on.
Because it's a funny thing, isn't it? With other issues of health in relation to your body, you kind of can sense what's going on. The thing when you have when you have potential heart problems, is you don't, do you?
Often that's the case.
And you feel fine.
We, in fact, have too many relatively young people who've got no idea. They're carrying risk factors that may include high blood pressure and cholesterol. And because they haven't actually gone and had those conversations, they don't know that they're carrying those risk factors. So the really critical thing is to understand what your risk is and understand what you can do about it. And for most of those risk factors, you can actually
do something
significant. Family history, as you've said, that's a different gig. But you can modify those other things and actually still improve your overall health and the overall likelihood of developing
illness. Are we getting a better and healthier heart population? I mean, are we improving things, or is it, hard to improve generally?
It's really hard to improve. And there's not a yes or no or an even answer to any of that. But the fact is, I think we all know that Australians are becoming, as a population, more overweight, not less overweight. We know they're becoming more sedentary. Very few are getting the amount of physical activity that they should be getting. We know that takeaway and eating out is, you know, more and more common for all of us. You know, smoking rates are probably the biggest success story we've got population-wide, and yet those lower socioeconomic groups are still really significantly overrepresented in smokers. So it's not a good news story, and our kids are the most chauffeured generation ever. So there's a lot to do.
So what? So are we not improving heart attack rates, heart disease results?
No, we are absolutely improving survival. And we are lowering, I mean, you know, post-World War II, that's when the males in our population were literally dropping like flies. Smoking rates were incredibly high. We've improved dramatically since then, but the overall health of the population and, you know, we're living longer. So we actually need to reduce our risk of heart disease and our ability to live well and in a healthy way over a much longer period of time.
Yeah.
I mean, 60 used to be old, and I can tell you it's not now.
Not at all. No, no, not at all. Not at all. Well, of course, in the news recently, we had one of the Wiggles, didn't we, collapsing from a heart attack at a concert they were giving, and fortunately was brought back with the handy intervention of a nurse who was in the concert. And she brought her skills to bear, and also there was a defibrillator present as well. Can we bring you in here, Raj?
Sure.
There's a bit of a... I mean, it's terrific news for Greg Page, and, you know, fantastic effort by the nurse to bring him back as well. There might be a belief that if a defibrillator is around, then all will be well, but that's not the case, is it?
Oh, look, I think that the response is really important. And when you look at... life support or CPR, there's basic CPR and there's advanced CPR. And it's a really important message in the community that basic CPR, which is the ability to recognize an unconscious person and respond quickly to giving cardiac compressions until a defibrillator or an ambulance arrives, is incredibly important. And in fact, the ability to bring someone back in that situation will be dependent on not just the defibrillator, but the community response. So what was key was we had a nurse who knew this technique of basic CPR and then could defibrillate the patient when the technology was around. So this is a skill that the whole community really should be aware of.
Yeah. When you say this, I mean, we're talking basic CPR. This is the placing of the two hands in the middle of the chest and compressing the chest cavity.
Absolutely.
Which squeezes the heart and allows it to expand and contract.
So we know that when the heart stops effectively beating, that circulation can be artificially generated for a period of time.
Right.
What we want is we want to maximize the oxygen that's within your body. It's like going deep sea diving. Take a breath, you go under, and you've got enough oxygen to last you a while. And if you can take advantage of that circulation by providing cardiac compressions until that defibrillator comes back and converts the heart's rhythm from chaos back to normal again, you can save someone's life.
Can we talk about the anatomy of the heart a bit?
Sure.
I mean, it is an extraordinary thing, isn't it? Ticking away there, unattended for millions of beats throughout our lifetime. I mean, maybe, I don't know, maybe it's tens of millions of beats.
Well, look, from my perspective, this is what attracted me to this organ, so to speak, is that you've got 60 to 90 beats per minute for 80 years of your life, and it just doesn't stop. We're trying to work out how to keep it going, and the components are really important. This is a muscle pump, and it's got some important plumbing, it's got some important electrics, and it's got some very important valves. And most of the technology and the research goes along those lines about how to optimize or improve things when aspects of the heart go wrong.
If your heart stops, do you immediately lose consciousness?
Yeah, if you have no...
What, instantly?
If you have no effective heartbeats, you lose consciousness, you drop.
Really?
And you become unconscious.
And how quickly do you die?
Well, this is the thing, that you can maintain a level of oxygen, say with CPR, for 5, 10, 15 minutes. And normally in our world, you know, saying to Kerry and others before, I just travel back from India from holidays, family holidays, where there's no effective ambulance service in a rural area that I was at. But in local Sydney, if someone were to drop within 5 or 10 minutes, you'd have a response from an ambulance. And people have to recognise that this is an emergency and activate that protocol. But these days, the ambulance will do an ECG, will transmit it to my phone and say, look, I think this guy's having a heart attack. And within 15 minutes, they'll be up in the angiogram lab having their stent and their artery open. So we have a fabulous system locally that's very well resourced, but it takes people to recognise the signs and symptoms.
Sure. What's the if your heart stops? I mean, it may stop for many reasons. I'm sure you can detail some of them. What's the but if it stops because of a blockage, for example, and that's a reason why your heart can stop. What does the defibrillator do? I mean, it doesn't unblock the blockage.
No. So usually, what happens is you have three heart arteries that sit around your heart. These are like the water pipes to a garden. This is how I describe it to my patients. Usually one will be blocked. There'll be some supply from the other two. And as a process, as a manifestation of this blockage, the heart's electricity becomes chaotic. Mm-hmm. And that's when the defibrillator kicks in, at least says, let's have some effective heartbeats, even though the heart's struggling. The garden's not getting enough water, but we're going to at least keep it going for a period of time. And that's what the defibrillator's doing in that situation. It's converting the heart's rhythm back to some normality. Even though the heart's struggling, it'll give us enough time to transport the patient to a place where we can open the artery up.
Okay, because, I mean, the common movie view of these things is that, you know, you put the paddles on, stand back, everybody, and you administer this convulsive electric shock, which has never seemed very therapeutic when you see it. Is that what it is, that it administers a sudden electric shock to the heart?
So when we're talking about the heart's anatomy, we have blood flow on the outside to this muscle pump. And within the actual muscle, we've got a series of very, very well put together electric circuits. They're well wired, like the telegraph wires down your street. So it's very organized. And when heart muscle, which conducts that electricity, starts to die, the actual electricity becomes very chaotic, and the defibrillator is restoring normality by temporarily stopping the heart in its chaos and then allowing the chief conductor, which sits right at the top, it's called the sinus node, lets the sinus node start conducting again and lets it normal beat contract.
Okay, so it administers a massive shock to the heart, which allows the heart to regroup and start up again.
Correct.
If it doesn't start up again...
Well, we try again.
We try again.
And it's important that we have an algorithm with CPR that will take us through those 5, 10, hopefully less than 15 minutes where we know that there's still an effective circulation we can deliver where this can be successful. The longer that runs, the more the heart muscle dies, the less oxygen in the system, and then the heart will not recover.
I remember speaking to a cardiologist some time ago who said, you know, it's not true because, and this is part of the problem with movies, is that people generally believe if you have a heart attack and there's a, you know, a defibrillator machine there or somebody who's in attendance, you'll survive. But that's actually not true, is it? Generally, heart attacks are fatal.
You make a good point that you need to use that as a bridge to understanding what has caused that. Now, some people have a primary electrical event, and so that is where they may be born with an electrical disorder of the heart. There are conditions called long QT syndrome and other syndromes where the electricity is just always predisposed to be abnormal. We don't know that when someone collapses. Then there are other people who have heart muscle problems where the heart is just weak and their only manifestation of this will be an electrical problem. And others who will have a heart blockage. So at that point in time, we're uncertain of the cause, but we need time. And this is what will give us a chance to work that out.
We're talking heart health tonight. Raj Puranik's just been speaking with us. He's a clinical cardiologist and associate professor from the University of Sydney. Kerry Doyle's also with us, CEO of the New South Wales Heart Foundation. You've got a personal story, Kerry.
I do.
Your own heart situation.
I guess I have...
Do you mind me asking what it was?
No, not at all. I guess I have two personal stories. Raj's explanation resonated very strongly with me because I lost my dad at age 76, which once upon a time was elderly, but these days is not, to his second heart attack. He was stepping out of the house to go and watch the second State of Origin
mm-hmm.
with my husband, who was just parked across the road to pick him up. And when he finally pulled the car up, he couldn't see Dad anymore. He'd actually had a massive heart attack, a blockage, and had, you know, exactly the same as the yellow wiggle, had just hit the ground. My husband is lucky enough, I guess, to have been somebody who had learnt to do CPR, recognised what he was seeing, and worked on Dad. The ambulance arrived with the defib, sent the ECG back. Unfortunately, it was a catastrophic heart attack, and Dad couldn't be saved. But everything that could be done for him was done. Fast forward 7 or so years, and the conversation about not utterly being able to outrun your family history. I availed myself of a heart health check. My wonderful GP and I arm wrestle around blood pressure, because I only have high blood pressure when I visit her. and the rest of the time it's quite normal. But my cholesterol had been slowly creeping up over a number of years. And, you know, I didn't particularly have a great deal of weight to lose. You know, all of the other risk factors I was were low, and I was managing them quite well. Couldn't get the cholesterol down, so the only answer is then to go on a statin. So I'll be on a statin probably for a long time.
Well, that's one of the things, isn't it, Raj? The drug therapy is much more effective than it used to be in relation to at least two of the important risk factors in heart disease, which are blood pressure and cholesterol. Can we talk about cholesterol? I mean, and you know, what Kerry said, the use of statins. I want to have a discussion about statins in a moment, but just back on the issue of blood pressure, it's important, isn't it, to not let your blood pressure be too high for too long?
Yeah, look, I think the important thing here is that these are established risk factors, as Kerry had mentioned, and it's how the risk factors interact that's very important. Blood pressure is, as is cholesterol, are two risk factors that manifest no symptoms. You wouldn't know
whether you've got high blood pressure or not. No.
And so this is why it's important to engage in a program. The issue about risk factors that you had discussed before is important, because the context is cardiovascular disease is a lifelong process. Nobody gets to 60 and just has a heart attack. This process starts from the time you're born, and you have times in your life when you have an opportunity to intervene. So if your blood pressure is detected as elevated in your 20s or 30s, I see it as a unique opportunity to actually make a change to avoid that heart attack at 60.
Why does high blood pressure matter?
It does, because it puts enormous strain on the heart arteries and the artery wall. So you can think of it as the forces that are generated by the heart to circulate the blood from the top of your head to the tips of your toes. And the more pressure you put on the artery wall, the more likely that artery wall becomes inflamed, irritated, and starts to rupture. Plaque forms, and the plaque will break off and cause a heart attack.
So high blood pressure really means that the heart, is working harder to pump the stuff around?
Yeah, it is the pressure that the heart's contracting against to get blood out of the heart. So it's a bit like if the analogy of a biceps curl. If you think of your heart as the bicep muscle and you think of the weights that you're contracting against, well, the harder you have to push against those bicep curls, the bicep starts to thicken. And whilst that looks good on your bicep, when that happens in your heart, your heart muscle starts to thicken, your heart then has a chance to potentially fail. Arteries start to become affected, and you develop the substrate for heart disease.
Once upon a time, there wasn't, diet and exercise can have a dramatic effect on blood pressure, but so can modern drugs. And for many people, that's an option, isn't it?
Look, the mainstay for blood pressure treatment is to first make sure that your blood pressure is elevated. Now, we know that people episodically, intermittently have elevations of blood pressure. There'll be certain situations, as Kerry's alluded to, at the doctor's surgery, where you get white coat hypertension, even though none of us wear the white coats, but it does become elevated. And persistent elevation of blood pressure can be confirmed with multiple checks with your local doctor. They're quite an easy thing. People have their own gadgets. I know Kerry's brought one in to potentially test your blood pressure, if you like, today.
I'm happy to have a go.
But this is an easy thing for people to do, and it is the average blood pressure over a number of measurements that's very important. So it wouldn't be that you turn up as a one-off visit, have a high number and suddenly you're on therapy. You'd need to confirm that measurement over a series of measurements.
Sure.
And then look for reasons why people might have blood pressure. Because there are a group of people, they're probably the minority, who have a reversible cause for high blood pressure. And once it's established that you don't have an actual cause, it's not another problem manifesting, we call that essential hypertension and we go on and treat that. And the drugs are very effective.
That's right. And relative, I mean, well, when I say relatively recent, I mean, they are relatively recent, aren't they? They're more effective, way more effective than they were, say, a generation ago.
I think what we're beginning to understand with the research is that we know the different pathways that the blood pressure works from.
Mm-hmm.
So the blood pressure is elevated because there are four or five pathways that are involved. And over time, we've established one pathway followed by the next and the next, and we basically have developed blockers to the various pathways, and now we have a very good gamut of blood pressure therapies that are effective. So for some people, it will be one pathway more than the other. So people get frustrated when one drug doesn't seem to work, and that's because there are probably four or five other pathways that aren't being knocked out.
Okay, yeah. So talk to your doctor again. This is the point you're making, Kerry.
Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. Can we talk? Okay, well, that's blood pressure. Can we talk about cholesterol? The cholesterol story's kind of got more complicated, hasn't it, than it used to be? I mean, once upon a time, high cholesterol equals bad and low cholesterol equals good. We're a bit more nuanced about it these days, aren't we, Raj?
I'm not.
Okay.
my background.
Well, I mean, in the sense that the story about cholesterol is probably more complicated than we thought, though.
It is. There are complexities. I mean, I should say my PhD, which was funded by the Heart Foundation, was actually in the good cholesterol, in HDL, but this is going back about 15 years ago. So I followed the cholesterol story very closely over time. And from my perspective, if you plot risk against cholesterol, you have a inverse linear relationship. That is,
okay.
if you drop your cholesterol, you
so there's a you're saying it's a direct relationship.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. So over the population, the higher. But I mean, is it a link personally, or is it just a statistical link over the population?
No, so this is when you put all the people in all the various trials together that have looked at cholesterol and looked at outcome. This is a linear relationship. There is no doubt about that. What happens is when you translate that epidemiologic information to the individual, then different interactions of their other risk factors come to play. But what's really important to know is the most modifiable of the cholesterol parameters is probably now the LDL, the bad cholesterol, is what we focus on, and the total cholesterol to get them to target. But it's really important to understand that from our perspective, lower is better. There will be people at higher levels of cholesterol that may not have a heart attack, may not manifest, and other people at lower levels of cholesterol that will. But this is because it's a linear relationship across the population. But the individual risk, as Kerry was talking about, the absolute risk for the individual is the important thing, is the interaction of all the risk factors.
Okay. That's why this modern class of drugs called statins has become so, I don't want to use the word popular, widespread. I mean, a lot of people take statins these days. And, you know, I know when I consulted a cardiologist a while ago, he was, you know, he had quite some zeal about them and said, look, you know, there's no question that they do, in his view, a great deal of good. Because statins work, as I understand, you can explain the detail, Rush, statins work to reduce your cholesterol, don't they?
So if you look at the cholesterol and how you can modify it, about 20% of your blood cholesterol is determined by what you eat and what you do.
Mm-hmm.
About 80% of your cholesterol is determined by your liver producing it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are enzymes in your liver that produce it, and the statin inhibits that enzyme. So you can shut down the factory production because it's way too much in your body.
Okay.
And now, because we know when you're born, your cholesterol's two, when they've done carbon dating studies and they've looked at, you know, if you want to go back to the caveman, cavewoman era, that the average cholesterol in the community might have been about two, and now the average cholesterol may be about five. Yet our physical requirements, our physical energy expenditure is so much less that cholesterol will deposit somewhere, and it's usually preferentially arteries. Now, what statins do is they reduce that production to a level that we think is much more compatible with what our physical levels of energy are and what our requirements are. And in 2016, the Lancet Journal basically answered all the questions that everybody had by combining 30 years of statin research into one paper.
Mm-hmm.
And there it was overwhelmingly positive that statins delivered huge benefits for cardiovascular disease, that's heart and stroke, and that the incidence of dementia or adverse effects through the various problems, cancer, other things that have been mentioned, have not occurred at any level that was causing them any significant problems.
And that's important to say, isn't it? Because, I mean, whenever we raise the topic of statins on the program here, I mean, there'll be people who say, oh, I don't know, I've heard that, you know, that they can cause cognitive problems.
Yes.
Other people point to other issues. It is true that some people can't tolerate statins.
Absolutely.
And, you know, in that case, the answer is don't take them.
In that case, there's an algorithm you work through with your GP and your cardiologist, and you can usually find the lowest dose that suits, maybe a couple of times a week on a very humble dose of a statin, or there are alternatives. You know, one of the big breakthroughs has been an injectable form of a drug that reduces your LDL cholesterol. So people are taking two or three injections every month and reducing their cholesterol. So there are different methods of reducing cholesterol now for people who aren't tolerant of statins, but you'd look to alternatives rather than abandon ship.
Okay. Raj, Alison in DWise texted saying, and this was a question, in fact, that I was going to ask you too, does resting heart rate matter for heart disease? Because people who are into exercise, for example, are fond of boasting about their resting heart rate, and the lower the better. Although, I mean, mine's relatively high, for example. I mean, but I've been told that there is a natural variation in heart rates. Is it a simple equation of lower is better?
No, look, heart rate is really a reflection of your physical state at any one point in time. Mm-hmm. Yes, the resting heart rate is generally much lower in individuals who are very fit, elitely fit.
Mm-hmm.
But we have a broad normal range, you know, between 60 and 90 beats per minute. Certainly when people breach that and they're very much under 50 and they're not particularly fit, that would be a cause for concern. If they're well above 100 and they're feeling unwell, then that would be a reason to seek out some help.
But a high resting heart rate, provided you're attending to other matters, is not necessarily a bad sign, is it?
Look, I would stick to those parameters. You know, I think if your heart rate, some people are geared to a slightly higher heart rate and they're generally totally fine. So if you're asymptomatic and you're in those ranges, I think it's okay.
Mm. Just before we take some calls, the other big thing, diagnostic treatment these days is medical imaging. I mean, it's expensive, I know, but this has revolutionised the way you can look at people's hearts, isn't it? Because once upon a time, you really, short of actually excavating yourself, which I know as skilled surgeons you can do, but that's always traumatic in relation to getting access to the heart. These days, with MRI imaging in particular, you can actually take quite detailed photographs of the inside of blood vessels in the heart, can't you?
Yeah, look, this is very much my pet interest has been to develop an MRI program here at Prince Alfred, and it's through the support of the Heart Foundation in my postdoc days back in London. We found that MRI has been very much restricted in our country in terms of access for the heart.
Mm.
It's very easily accessible for the brain and for knee joints. But
why is that?
Well, there was a while ago where one of our health ministers restricted activity and so the heart was not considered an indication that was worthy, because probably we have ultrasound and angiograms and ECGs and other things.
Mm-hmm.
And we found that especially in a group of patients who are born with complex heart disease, congenital heart disease, really didn't have a choice in this matter, who become more and more complicated to image over time, that MRI provides enormous insights and minimizes the number of invasive procedures. See, with all the different techniques and technologies that we have now, the issue is really which is the right fit for you.
Yeah.
And the pendulum has swung back to imaging to help us select the right treatment for the right patient. And that's where the MRI is extremely important in many, many aspects of cardiovascular disease.
Mm. Yeah, Kerry, a GP is not going to readily give you access to this, are they? I mean, in fact, can they?
So, look, there's a series of steps that they're going to take. Raj is, focused on people with complex and heart conditions, often congenital, where, you know, this is not the only place where I'm sure he would use an MRI, but where it's absolutely a game changer in terms of being able to see what is going on, things that might be obscured because there've been multiple surgeries, multiple treatments. That's not a patient who is going to be under the care of a GP in the same way that I might be under the care of a GP. That patient's going to be under the care of somebody like Raj himself.
Of a specialist, yeah. All right, let's take a call or two. Gary, hello.
Hi, thanks for the call. I'm in Pakenham in Victoria. My wife suffered what turned out to be a fatal heart attack 2 months ago. We were out in a public occasion having a nice time with some other friends, and suddenly between courses almost, we wondered where she was and discovered her face down on the carpet. Some minutes went by, I think a bit of panic before we could find out. It was in a public place, so eventually some CPR, someone with CPR skills, and then a little while after that, defibrillator. To cut to the chase, it turned out all of these events proved to be unsuccessful. The eventually coroner was involved because it was in a public place. The cause of death was shown to be ischemic heart disease or narrowing of the arteries. Would there have been any way, she was under a cardiologist, having had a minor heart attack at the age of 44, she was 71 when this happened 2 months ago, would there have been anything such as an echocardiogram or anything of that sort that would have shown ischemic heart disease being present?
Yeah, well, our sympathies on the loss of your wife, Gary. It's a terrible trauma. Raj, would you want to take this one on?
Yeah, look, Gary, my sincerest condolences. Yeah. Look, one of the really tricky things about an acute heart attack is that we know now that blockages build up over time. So people can go from having a 30, 40, 50% blockage up to an 80% blockage, and they might get symptoms because there's not enough blood flow. But there is also a time when people actually have a spontaneous event, like what has happened to your wife, where a blockage may be virtually not even apparent on imaging. It may be a 10 or 20% blockage. We actually know the most common type of blockage to cause an acute heart attack is one of these very small ones, because out of the blue, with no warning, they become inflamed and irritated, and then they rupture. And for that, there is no warning. And in fact, despite all the medical research that we have in this game, and there's been a lot invested, that we still don't have an answer for that. And unfortunately, sometimes there is a possibility of this very unpredictable event.
So an echocardiogram, for example, doesn't give you that. It's only, am I right in saying that the only way that you'd really see what's really going on there would be an angiogram, and you're not likely to do that unless there are symptoms.
That's right. An echocardiogram focuses on heart muscle, so we're looking downstream from the blockage. So it might tell us that all the heart is actually working well right up to that very point, because that even if that was done half an hour before or a week before, you'd say that that was normal. This is something that happens spontaneously at that moment.
Yeah, I don't know whether it's a comfort or not, Gary, but thank you. Thanks for the question, and as I say, our condolences on the loss of your wife too. Al, hello.
Yep, hello.
Hi.
Yeah, I found out about 15 years ago, I've got an incompetent bicuspid aortic valve. It leaks. It doesn't shut off when it fills up my heart, but it still leaks after it closes. And I heard that they can't operate through keyhole at this stage because it's a bicuspid valve.
Bicuspid valves that leak are probably best handled with an open replacement of this valve. So surgical techniques now are fabulous in terms of replacing valves. The timing of replacing a valve is complicated, and usually that algorithm is determined by the cardiologist and the cardiac surgeon. Will be dependent on a lot of factors: how you're feeling, how you do on a treadmill, how bad the leak is on the echocardiogram. But you're right, most aortic valves have three leaflets, When you have a bicuspid valve, this is the most common abnormality you can be born with. About 1% of the population have a bicuspid valve. That is two leaflets rather than three leaflets.
Yeah.
About only 2/3 of people with a bicuspid valve actually end up with an operation. That is 30-40% of people actually have a bicuspid valve they can have for their whole life and have some other reason that that they die from. So the timing of surgery is the most important thing. The minimally invasive or the keyhole approaches, we're just starting to locally pioneer and champion, and there are several centres around Australia that are now doing valve replacements through keyhole techniques. Most of the time, it is a three-leaflet valve that it's being done for, and most of the time it's being done for stenosis, that is blockage of that valve rather than leak.
That's the last I heard when I saw my cardiologist last.
Yeah, we find it's not as effective for the leaky valve.
Yeah, that's what he said. And I have a yearly checkup, and every 2 years I have a ECG, and the last 15 years it's been moderate and it hasn't changed over that time. Since they found it.
People can carry that for quite a while and not need intervention. And be reassured, cardiac surgery in Australia is excellent. People do well.
Good on you. Thanks, Al. I get the impression, is this true, Raj, that surgery, I mean, it's a miracle. I know, and the things that surgeons can do are nothing short of miraculous, but that's much less common these days, that there are other less invasive techniques. I mean, I know you've been interested in the insertion of stents, for example, through the groin, which is maybe equally miraculous. But the stents, rather than, for example, bypass surgery, have made things less invasive, haven't they?
Yeah. Look, we've seen the natural history of this at my centre at RPA, where the first angiogram in Australia was actually ever done, maybe 50, 60 years ago. And at that point, we were able to see how many blockages there were, and everybody got surgery because we didn't have balloons or stents. Then about 20 years later, we got balloons, and we found that when we ballooned a blockage, about 1 in 2 people would come back. It'd be 50% return of that blockage. And then about 30 years ago, we got stents. And so we ballooned the blockage. We got rid of most of the blockage. Then we deployed a metal stent. It looks like a little piece of chicken wire that sits around the artery and holds the artery open. And we found that 50% recurrence rate dropped to about 20%. And then in the last 15 years, we've had a drug coating within the stent that actually further diminished that rate of recurrence down to about a couple of percent, 2 or 3%. So we're finding that transition of those patients who need surgery has dropped, but there are still conditions where the main artery of the heart gets blocked or multiple blockages exist that surgery is required. We'll never replace surgery, but surgery is now being done at our centre with robotic assistance and done with very small holes and on the beating heart to minimise any trauma to the brain so that we're not on the pump machine. So there are some extremely good techniques emerging in cardiac surgery.
Okay, let's take some more calls. John wants to know how much coffee you can drink. Hello, John.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure.
My question is, how much coffee is too much for your heart? Because I don't know if it's just me, but sometimes when I have coffee, I can actually feel that my heart rate's going up. And then, I mean, I don't know, is that a good thing? Because, I mean, isn't that the same thing that happens when you exercise? But, yeah, that's my question today.
Yeah, look, I think everything in moderation is the key here, is what I would suggest. There are some people who are predisposed and feel palpitations as their heart rate goes up. You know, caffeine is a stimulant, and energy drinks are the other big group of products that we're seeing young people.
Well, they're just loaded with caffeine, aren't they?
Absolutely, who are now manifesting with various arrhythmias, so rhythm problems. But generally speaking, a couple of coffees a day would not be a problem for most individuals. And I think to be sensible, if your body's telling you you're getting palpitations, you've got to listen to your body and respond and reduce the amount of caffeine.
Okay. All right. So look, in general, a couple of cups of coffee a day is okay. Can we ask about calcium scores? These have become a kind of bit of a buzz thing, haven't they? The getting of a calcium score through imaging or something else has again sort of resulted in a league table. High calcium score equals bad, low calcium score equals good. What's your own take on this, Raj?
Yeah, look, I think there are a lot of people who are now aware of, as Kerry had mentioned, the absolute risk of having a cardiac event.
Mm.
And so this is something that the Heart Foundation have really championed locally. And there are a lot of people who are stuck in the middle, which is that they have not low but not high but intermediate risk.
Mm-hmm.
And they're on the threshold of treatment and wondering whether they should or shouldn't engage in, say, statin treatment. And the calcium score provides some epidemiologic population-based data that then allows us to further risk stratify people. So if it is elevated and you're intermediate risk, you might be more likely to go onto statins or blood pressure-lowering therapies. So it's very useful to risk stratify patients. And it's a very sensible and easy thing to do that doesn't, you know, have much cost or effort.
Mm. Do statins actually reduce the build-up of deposits on your arteries, or do they just stop it getting worse?
Look, the holy grail is to make blockages go backwards.
Correct.
Like that, if we could do that...
We don't have a drug that does that, do we?
No. If we could induce regression of plaque, that would be the goal.
Mm.
What we do with statins is a number of things. So people get fixated on the fact that my cholesterol is at this level, and so I don't need it, or I should have it. But actually, statins stabilize plaque. So I talked about, we had Gary, the listener, whose wife had this acute plaque rupture. And what we're trying to do is make these arteries as stable as possible to reduce the inflammation in the arteries. So statins do that.
Mm.
They actually take away some of the cholesterol component of the plaque to make that stable phenotype so it doesn't actually rupture over time. And so statins have a number of effects that are very beneficial for the heart that's beyond just the cholesterol lowering.
Mm. Ed's had three heart attacks. Hello, Ed.
Hello, Philip. How are you?
Not too bad. You're still with us.
Yeah, still with you. I don't know why.
Good on you. One might be too many, Ed. Three's way too many.
Yeah, I had one in 2009. I was on holidays at the time and I didn't even know I was having it.
Yeah.
I had shoulder pain leading up to it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I told the AMBOs and they said, oh, the heart doesn't know where the pain is, so it sends it to other parts of the body. Is that correct?
Yeah, this is called referred pain. So the same nerves that innervate your arm also innervate the heart. They pick up messages from the heart as well, so you can feel it in
this is why people who are having heart attacks often feel a pain down their arm, isn't it?
Yes, and it may be in their jaw or teeth sometimes.
Really?
Very similar, yep.
Yeah. Ed, I presume you're in the hands of some medical attention, aren't you?
I've got that many medications. I'm like a walking pharmacy. I'm blood thinners, so...
Mm-hmm.
And a statin's the cholesterol.
Yeah, that's right. Yep.
Yeah, I'm on two lots of them, and then blood pressure tablets. You could count them on my hand.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Okay.
And then I had two heart attacks in 2017.
From our point of view, that the disappointing thing in your case is that for most people after their initial heart attack, if they go on to this combination of medications, you reduce the risk of a subsequent heart attack by up to 80%. So there are a small group of individuals who are predisposed and go on to have heart attacks like our caller. But in the main, the majority of people will have their risk reduced to a level where it doesn't become a problem again.
Yeah.
And it's important to get the message that the medications work for the most.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. My poor old dad had a heart attack, I think when he was 59, but he didn't die of it. He died when he was 84, but not of a heart attack. Mm. It was an example of, and he certainly attended to it at a time when the drugs were not as effective, of course, as they are now. Brian, you've got a low heart rate, have you?
Yes, good evening, gents. I'm 69.
Yeah.
I've been fit and active for a long time, and I've known I've had a heart rate in the low 40s for quite a long number of years now, and I've had several ECGs as a result of work the last few years, and I did a stress test about 8 years ago, and they couldn't detect any bradycardia or arrhythmia.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I'm a blood donor, but they knocked me back the other day and said, look, you have to go back to your doctor and when they checked me heart rate, my pressure, blood pressure was fine, always has been fine, but my pulse rate was 35. So they sent me off and just asked, well, what do you think about that?
Yeah, look, it needs to be evaluated. As I said, the red flags for us would be patients who have heart rates in the 40s and 30s, that they need to be evaluated. Doesn't necessarily mean that any treatment's required, because the most important component is how you're feeling. So if you're feeling well at that heart rate, the yep. chances are people will provide surveillance and nothing major will need to happen. The stress test is important because it tells you how your heart responds to exercise. And the problem is that people who have low heart rates with disease, they don't mount a heart rate response. You should be able to double or triple your heart rate mm-hmm. when you exercise. And that's mm-hmm. what the stress test is telling you. It tells you how much reserve you've got.
Okay.
So if you can do that on a treadmill, then you can say, look, I always run a low heart rate, but I can mount a response when I need it.
Mm. Okay.
That's all the right. key.
Okay. Thanks, Brian. One other thing I should ask you about is low-dose aspirin, because this was very popular for a long period until a big study suggested that it probably didn't make any difference. Is that still the case, Raj?
Yeah, that's right. Look, for we talk about risk and we talk about primary prevention and secondary prevention. So when we talked about the people who'd had a heart attack and we're preventing a second one, for secondary prevention, there's no doubt that they go on to a cocktail of medications, which includes aspirin, and it's very effective. But for primary prevention, where people have never had a heart attack before,
yeah.
that the role of aspirin is now virtually obsolete because we know that the risk of bleeding is increased.
Yeah.
And in fact, I would focus our attention more back on the cholesterol, blood pressure and blood sugars and the simple things like physical activity and weight.
Because that's the thing, isn't it, Kerry, that you know, almost all our discussions about health end up at diet and exercise, in other words, looking after yourself. Understanding that, you know, getting a heart check from your GP is important, but these other primary healthcare factors are just terribly important in heart health, aren't they?
Extremely important. Mm. But again, your GP is a really critical part of helping you to put a plan together to address even those things that we often think we just need to take care of ourselves. They can help you, as can the Heart Foundation, with, you know, kind of healthy eating patterns and tips and tricks to actually make, you know, a little build-up of your exercise regime. There's no reason to run out, you know, try and do a marathon as your first thing, but just, you know, join a walking group, just change up some things in your diet. But there's still only two parts of the equation: your family, your broader lifestyle risk factors, blood pressure, cholesterol, and any kind of comorbidities that you might have. It's the whole picture that's really critical, particularly once people are over 40.
How important is it? I mean, we're often being told by exercise people it's very important to get your heart rate up every day. When you're older, though, is it that important? Or is it important, or could it even be harmful?
So I might hand to our clinician to answer that from a clinical perspective, but exercise at any age as a general principle is good for you.
I'm not being negative about exercise, but this idea that you need, particularly when you're older, I mean, let's, you know, for older people, over 60, for example, is it important to get your heart rate up?
Yeah, look, a lot of the exercise regimes now, the high-intensity exercise, has become quite fashionable.
Yeah.
From a practical perspective, what I say to patients is there's three levels of exercise. Level one is the simple walk around the block. Your heart rate may not go up. You may not lose weight, but you'll benefit from a heart perspective. Just a simple walk around the block, 30 minutes, five times a week. The next level is when you hit the treadmill, get the heart rate up. You'll lose weight, you'll feel the benefits, you're really creating extra little blood vessels. And the third level is that elite level of activity, which you don't need to do. So really, consistency is the key.
Yes, you don't need to overdo it. All right. Sadly, time's escaped from us. It always does when we've got an interesting topic like this. I do thank you for your time. Kerry Doyle is the CEO of the New South Wales Heart Foundation, and Dr. Raj Piranik is a clinical cardiologist with the University of Sydney. Thanks to both of you.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.